Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Ebola death toll nears 5,000, and President Obama names a new attorney general. I'm Joe Palca, reporting from Washington. The World Health Organization says the death toll from the Ebola crisis has risen to 4,960, with more than 13,200 others infected with the disease. Health officials say while the death toll continues to rise, the rate of the increase has declined. This weekend marks 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The event signaled the beginning of the end of the German Democratic Republic, otherwise known as East Germany. Henry Ridgewell is in Berlin.
As Berliners prepare to celebrate this weekend, there is a growing debate over what is known as Ostalgie, the surviving infrastructure of the old regime. Sections of the Berlin Wall, preserved checkpoints, secret prisons, provide a strong antidote to Ostalgie. Conditions in East Germany led thousands to risk their lives trying to cross to the West, says Berlin Wall Memorial Director Axel Klausmeier.
There was no political freedom of speech, no freedom of travel, and no freedom for the press. And the Stasi, the secret police, was everywhere.
For younger generations in unified Germany, Ostalgie is confined to museums and history books. For many of those who grew up in the East, childhood nostalgia is mixed with painful memories. Henry Ridgewell, Berlin.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Pakistani officials say at least 17 militants were killed overnight in a failed raid on a military checkpoint in a northwestern border region. Military officials said the clash erupted Friday night in the Khyber tribal district bordering Afghanistan when around 60 militants raided the security outpost. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama is authorizing U.S. military to deploy up to 1,500 more troops to Iraq as part of the mission to combat Islamic State militants. President Obama will also ask Congress for $5.6 billion to help fund the campaign. This is U.S. Admiral John Kirby.
It's a completely different situation, and we're confident that if we get the funding that we're requesting from Congress, that we'll be able to make significant progress in this regard. The other thing I'd add is one of the reasons why we think this is a good idea right now is because the Iraqi security forces have stiffened their spine and have gone on the offense.
White House officials say the troops will not serve in a combat role, but will help train and advise Iraqi and Kurdish forces fighting the group. Now, Ari Harsin, he's the head of the Defense Committee of the Kurdish Regional Government, says he'd like a little bit more.
If these 1,500 men, if they are supporting us by artillery in the back of the, not in the front, but in the back, artillery support, heavy weapons support is okay. But it's only, if it's only for the training, it is nothing to train about. It is Daesh, it is a postmodern partisan manner to fight. That's why I don't understand this.
U.S. officials say North Korea has released detained Americans Kenneth Bay and Matthew Todd Miller. They're now on their way back home. U.S. National Intelligence Director James Clapper was said to be accompanying the two. President Obama nominating New York federal prosecutor Loretta Lynch to join his cabinet as attorney general, the nation's top law enforcement official. The president expected to make the announcement today. If confirmed by the Senate, Lynch would replace outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder and become the first African-American woman to head the Justice Department. U.S. President Obama calling on Americans to do their part in honoring the country's military veterans. Ahead of the Federal Veterans Day holiday, Mr. Obama used his weekly address to pay tribute, especially to those in Afghanistan.
For more than 13 years, we've been at war in Afghanistan. Next month, our combat mission will be over, and America's longest war will come to a responsible end. But the end of a war is just the beginning of our obligations to those who serve in our name. These men and women will be proud veterans for decades to come, and our service to them has only just begun.
Speaker of the House John Boehner spoke from the Republican side, also paying tribute to the vets, but also talked about Election Day this past week.
Republicans are humbled by the trust the American people have placed in us, and we'll honor that trust by listening to you, by making your priorities our priorities.
This is Joe Palca from the VOA News Center in Washington, D.C.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There would be transitional government of national unity that would be established after a peace agreement.
The South Sudan warring leaders agree to form a national transitional government. We'll find out more.
There seems to be now dilly-dallying from the other side. That is the part of the opposition, together with the LCD faction.
Why is political tension in Lesotho still high after a recent agreement was brokered by South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa?
What was important with this new guideline is to introduce not only safe techniques, but also techniques of burial.
And the World Health Organization, WHO, unveils new burial protocols for victims of the dreaded Ebola disease. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar have agreed on a power-sharing leadership formula. Its goal is to establish a national transitional government that will help steer the world's newest nation to elections. The two warring leaders also called on their troops to immediately cease fire Friday. Earlier today, I reached Mr. Machar in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa and asked him whether he had confidence that the peace agreement could help resolve the country's conflict.
We agreed on the leadership functions of the would-be transitional government of national unity that would be established after a peace agreement. So we agreed on the leadership functions, that is, the functions of the president, the functions of the prime minister, and the functions that would be they would share joint functions. These are the ones we have agreed upon, but we still have to agree on the structure of the leadership.
So what are the discussions still ongoing about the structure of the leadership? What are some of these points that we are looking at here in this new agreement?
Well, from my perspective, I think if a peace agreement is going to be struck, it's a very serious commitment, and the two warring parties should shoulder the responsibility and steer the country towards unifying the country, uniting the country, and uniting the people, and also implementing the agreement. So I propose that it will be steered by the president and the prime minister. There are voices that want to include other structures within or between the prime minister and the president. So we left this to be discussed further. The president will discuss in Juba. I'm going to discuss in the bush with our leadership on how to go. And I think this is important. It is an important understanding. We have not signed it, but we have presented it before the IGAD summit and the heads of state and government are aware of this.
Is there a specific time frame within which this agreed upon segment of yet to be signed agreement to be implemented?
Well, first of all, this is just one aspect of the discussions we are making. We yet have to agree on system of governance and then the reforms that will be made after we have agreed on the system of governance, and also the accountability section. So we are moving forward, but we have taken a positive step towards getting to a peace agreement.
Why has this process dragged on for quite some time now, especially when both of you and President Kiir appear to want to bring some peace and stability, because all of you express concern about the suffering of the ordinary South Sudanese who is unarmed, especially women and children and vulnerable elderly. Why has this dragged on for all this while?
Well, part of it is the way the mediation is doing it. They get mediation. You know that we complain many times on the mediation process, and the government also, even as last week, also complained on the process. But we are trying to take charge now that we are talking face to face with each other, and I think there will be progress. And actually, we achieve the progress in face to face talks between me and President Salva Kiir.
What assurances are you and President Kiir giving to the people of South Sudan and the rest of the world about reaching an agreement that will hold and restore peace and stability and maintain South Sudan's territorial integrity?
You know, we don't want our country to be occupied by foreign forces. I know there is a threat about that. Our people are also suffering humanitarianly. They have been displaced. Many have lost their lives and property. It's a concern to me, and I believe that is also a concern to President Kiir. And therefore, we must push forward to get a peace agreement.
Riek Machar is the former vice president of South Sudan. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The chief whip of Lesotho's Senate expressed concern that tension in the country could get worse after some parliamentarians demanded the removal of a constitutional measure that empowers the prime minister to suspend parliament. Hwabani Theko said the demands could derail last month's agreement signed by the country's leaders to end political tension that led to an alleged attempt to overthrow Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's coalition government. Theko told me that it appears some politicians are displeased with the agreement in the run-up to the elections.
Apparently, I would say very little attention has gone down since the opening of Parliament, but instead of having to work on the program of doing the budget for the elections and maybe removing other impediments that were there before, so maybe if we could have another coalition, there seems to be now dilly-dallying from the other side. That is the part of the opposition, together with the LCD faction, are now trying to play some game that we cannot even explain. They've just made a motion in Parliament, in the National Assembly, where they wanted to put a motion to say they want to remove the prorogation from the Constitution. And mind you, this has been done by other people who have not even a single vote from the constituency in the Parliament. These gentlemen are just being used in maybe to test the power of the people on the other side, which is LCD, which is still the member of the coalition, but not in good terms, of course, with Mr. Thabane, who is the prime minister, and his other coalition, BNP gentlemen, Chief Priscilla Masribana. That has really brought some uneasiness again in our political fraternity. Now, number two, we still have a very big problem with the Tamudi guy, who is the lieutenant general. You remember, after that facilitation agreement, there was another security accord that was signed by all the generals, the police and the army. But he's refusing now to comply. It looks like he doesn't want to go on this leave that they were supposed to go to.
As a chief whip of the Senate and as a traditional ruler in Lesotho, have you made any efforts to the mediator, in this case, Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa, to come back or possibly to come and address some of these security challenges that you talked about?
Well, he has been here yesterday and the day before yesterday, trying to maybe call them into order. We hope things will prevail better after his leave and he has left.
So how are Basotho reacting to this new form of tension following what some people say is an infringement of the Maseru agreement that was signed, that only certain measures need to be taken in parliament before the elections?
Yeah, it brings a lot of confusion to people. And, of course, it very makes the situation to remain very combustible. You really do not know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow.
What is the next step forward, since it appears that the Maseru Accord that was signed between all political parties that have registered with the Electoral Commission are not being adhered in Parliament?
You see, the issue of going to election has never really come home to most of the people. They are not very comfortable with it. So they are trying to dilly-dally or maybe even cause the whole agreement to collapse. We don't know what is their timing or what is their, maybe what they are looking at after it has totally collapsed. But that will be very unfortunate for the Lesotho and Basotho with such a trivial economy that we have and so little power of Lesotho on its own. Even economy, it totally depends on South Africa. And then we never really listen to what South Africa has tried to bring. That is to say, the whole of SADC, the regional body, it will be very, very disappointed if something, because there are lots of people who are politicians, but who are really behaving in a very childish manner.
Hwabani Theko is the chief whip of Lesotho Senate. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Although the Ebola crisis may have abated somewhat, the fight to contain the epidemic and help its victims continues in West Africa. At a press conference in New York, Nicole Walden of the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, offered an update. The IRC helps people who lives and livelihoods are shattered by disaster to recover and gain control of their futures. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
In the U.S. government's Foreign Press Center next to the United Nations, Nicole Walden told reporters about the IRC's multi-pronged efforts to fight Ebola in Liberia.
It has ranged from investigating cases to identifying contacts that may have interacted with infected individuals and tracing those individuals for the 21-day incubation period. We've supported the establishment of infection prevention and control mechanisms within the health facilities around the country.
Walden explained that most of Liberia's health facilities closed when the epidemic began to rage out of control earlier this year.
People were too afraid. The health workers themselves had no confidence in their ability to keep themselves safe. And so health services have basically ceased to exist in the form of malaria or antenatal support, pneumonia until very recently. A number of health facilities' doors have reopened because of the support provided in training healthcare workers how to keep themselves safe.
Powerful clashes between traditional African culture and Western epidemiology have complicated fighting Ebola. In African culture, a corpse is handled by many loving hands before it is buried. But health workers know that direct contact with fluids from an infected body spreads the virus.
In the county where Monrovia sits, a couple of months ago, the situation was at such a critical level that it was decided to stop burials and make mandatory cremation for all dead bodies. This was extremely, extremely unpopular, disconcerting for families. It flies in the face of every cultural norm and tradition that people have. While some communities, you could get them on board with the science of it, but couldn't reconcile the emotion of it. We are exploring all options. How could we go back to burial practice? Where is a safe location? How can we make sure that safe burials can be possible again? I think that that will be happening imminently.
When asked whether the outbreak in Liberia may be getting under control, Walden offered a measured response. She said transmission rates do seem to be declining, but warned against complacency.
I think we're in a place now where this is far, far beyond a public health crisis. This is affecting every aspect of life, from the economy. Schools are closed. No education is happening. People are struggling to find jobs and don't have access to other types of health services. So people are affected. Their mental health, their social and emotional well-being and care is really starting to get highlighted as part of the response, something that hasn't been given enough attention to date. We need to redouble our efforts, not only in thinking about the medical activities and interventions that need to take place, but a really holistic way of looking at the new normal.
Containment and treatment clinics paid for by the United States and its allies continue to be built in Liberia and other West African nations where the epidemic is most severe. Meanwhile, Ebola-related deaths continue, especially in remote rural areas where access even to rudimentary health care is scarce to non-existent. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And safe burial procedures are considered key to reducing the transmission of Ebola in the three most heavily infected West African states. The World Health Organization says it has developed new burial protocols which are in line with the cultural and religious beliefs of Ebola-infected communities in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says the majority of Ebola infections in West Africa occur during unsafe burials. This is because a person killed by Ebola is most contagious right after he or she dies. WHO Ebola expert Pierre Formenti says burial rites that require directly touching or washing the body make family and community members vulnerable to contracting the Ebola virus.
During the months of August, I think we were close to 60% of the transmission due to burial. Now, thanks to the development and the creation of many burial teams in the three countries, we have decreased this number down to around 30. What was important with this new guideline is to introduce not only safe techniques, but also techniques of burial that will be accepted religiously by the different community, by the different families, by the different villages, and by the people.
Over the past few weeks, the WHO, working with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies and a number of faith-based organizations, updated the burial protocols to take into account the cultural and religious sensibilities of West African families and communities. Dr. Formenti says these discussions resulted in measures that allow families of the bereaved to perform sacred rites in a safe manner.
If you do a safe burial but without the dignity to the person who are dying, then the next family will refuse to accept the burial team, and then, of course, the transmission will augment.
Sally Smith, a community mobilization advisor at the UNAIDS agency, says there is no single blueprint for holding a dignified burial ceremony. She says it varies widely among different communities. Therefore, she says it is very important to ask people what is important for them and then figure out how this particular rite can be carried out in a safe way.
One of the things that was important for the Islamic community particularly was that the person was not buried naked. And that was the idea of then bringing a white cloth that could be laid on top of the body bag so that then when the body was placed on the body bag, the cloth could be folded over like a shroud. Again, for the Christian community, it was maybe reading a scripture verse. They may want to write that scriptural verse and put that inside the body bag with the person, or put a cross inside.
The WHO says it expects to reach about 70% safe burials in the Ebola-infected countries by December. While this will certainly reduce the transmission of the virus, it says safe burial practices are not enough to curb the epidemic. It says efforts must continue to isolate Ebola victims in treatment centers and to trace the contacts of those infected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Kenyan athlete Florence Kiplagat has won this year's Ames Female Best Marathon Runner of the Year award. She was decorated in Athens on Friday night, where she is to take part in the Athens Marathon on Sunday. For VOA, Andy Edwards caught up with her just before the ceremony.
We are backstage at the Ames Best Marathon Runner of the Year Awards in Athens, and the woman's winner, well, that is Florence Kiplagat, who's had a great year, broke the world half marathon record and was second in the London Marathon. Can you look back, Florence, and just think at the start of the year, were you confident of running so well?
Yeah, I look comfortable sometimes, but when it comes to a marathon, I still fear. I don't have enough confidence. I still have to gain it, you know.
That's interesting. So you've broken the world half marathon record and you're a very good marathon runner, but you feel you still have to learn about the marathon. You still have some of that fear.
Yeah, I have to, you know. I fear a long distance. Like, when I just arrived at like 38K, I feel like quitting from the race. Yeah. But in a half marathon, I'm very comfortable. Yeah.
We see you and Dennis Kimeto, who's won the men's award. You're all dressed up, looking very smart. We're used to seeing you in training gear, in tracksuits, and then racing. Is it nice to be putting on different clothes and not just be in a tracksuit all the time?
Yeah, for us, we believe we are in holiday. And to have that time, a privilege where you have been selected to do something, then you have to dress up nicely. You know, tracksuit is not a case, but we don't like it. Sometimes we need to be dressed up like people are going for dinner, something like that.
Well, I'm not a fashion correspondent, but I think your outfit looks very, very smart and very nice. Just thinking about athletics again, your plans for the marathon, you're one of those who've run 2:19 for the marathon. Do you think that you've got potential to run even faster in the marathon?
Yeah, I'm trying to run faster. You know, I need to improve it, but sometimes whenever I'm in a marathon, I find some conditions is not favorable. So I need to slow down. But next year, I hope, and I promise, I'll make sure that I just do something which can go in the book of records that I have done it. Yeah.
Well, that's the speedy Florence Kiplagat, certainly at the World Half Marathon, the record holder, and looking to run even faster at the marathon. All dressed up, looking very different to what we see normally of Florence, but winner of the Ames Best Marathon Runner Women's Category of the Year 2014. And we're in Athens. Thank you very much, Florence.
Thank you very much. Good day.
Andy Edwards speaking with the winner of this year's Ames Female Best Marathon Runner, Kenyan Florence Kiplagat.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Kill me. Ladies, come on. Do the boogie. ladies, do them good. Ladies, do them good. Ladies, do them good. Ladies, do them good. Ladies, do them good.
I love the way you dancing. It's high life dancing. I love the way you shaking. It's high life dancing. Go girl, why the west? Why the west? Why the west?
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for our Saturday commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure to share my reflections with the audience of The Voice of America. Every week, I pay close attention to the headlines with regard to U.S. policy towards Africa. And I also look at African opinions on an attitude toward the United States. This week, the whole world paid a great deal of attention to the elections in the United States. And these elections provide a good opportunity for all of us who are looking at America's relations with the world. Those from Africa who are looking at the elections paid a great deal of attention to the outcome. Many people will see the election as a defeat to the Democratic Party and, of course, consequently, a defeat to the president. The talking heads, as many people call our analysts, and those who are very serious journalists, whether they are broadcasters or they are writing for newspapers or they are bloggers, all of them have their opinions. There are thousands of opinions about the elections. Many of our analysts are putting forth their opinion. And if you're really interested in U.S. policy towards Africa and the implication of the elections, you have to pay a great deal of attention to the various editorials written by people who are looking at Africa and trying to understand what they said. So you can find these in the various news reports and see what other people are writing. And you can have from A to Z, from Angola to Zimbabwe, and see what all those people in the media are writing in those countries about the elections and the implications of the elections since the summit. The other thing is we have Ebola as a major problem in Africa, and people who are interested in Ebola and wondering whether Ebola has any effect in terms of the outcome of the elections. There are a number of points to be underlined here just to understand the elections and the implications they have for Africa. Number one, you have 50 African states represented in the United States months before the elections. Many of them maybe were paying attention to what democracy means for Americans and how Americans see democracy working in Africa. But between the summit and the declaration of Ebola all over the region in West Africa, particularly in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and the consequences briefly in Nigeria and Senegal, and the reaction to Ebola on the part of the African, here is the point of departure with regard to American policy towards Africa and the relations of this policy towards the election. American humanitarianism is going to be in the hands of the Republicans, both at the House level and the Senate level. This is where U.S. policy towards Africa with regard to humanitarianism is going to come from Obama with regard to the politics of bargaining and compromise. This is one of the legacy in American political history, and the Africans have to learn to see the benefit of political bargaining and compromise. It's an important political theory, which is rooted in American history. From the founding fathers to now, it's still there. What does that tell you about democracy? That in the game of democracy in the West, particularly in America, you will win and you lose. Africa will learn this lesson from the United States. Politics, you don't win all the time. You win and you lose. So this way, African leaders will learn this game. It became very evident in Burkina Faso recently, where some of these African leaders came to the ballot box, then they became dictators. Ali Mazrui used to say this about Ghana, that Kwame Nkrumah was democratically elected, but they established a one dictatorship. That was why the late Ali Mazrui used to say, Rawlings came as a military leader, he left as a Democrat. That's a legacy the Ghanaians have, and it's working for the Ghanaians. So if you're a Ghanaian politician, you now know you win and you lose, and you have to accept that. This is one thing Ghanaians have learned in terms of their own political engineering and political theory. From what the Europeans, as a young man, I remember this when I was in England, when Sir Alex Douglas Hume was running, and a young kid in England threw eggs at him. And I remember him saying, this can only happen in England, where you can do this. In another country, you will have a different outcome. These are three lessons from England. I knew that as a young man. I was a young kid at the time. And what is happening to President Obama? That you can be the head of state, you have 2 terms, but you might very well be humiliated because your party is defeated. This is a lesson for the Africans, that in politics, you don't win all the time. It's not a zero-sum game. You have to learn to accept the defeats. In conclusion, when we look at U.S. policy towards Africa, U.S. policy with regard to humanitarian in Africa, you can see how these elections tell the Africans and the Americans that if humanitarianism and American foreign policy is to be effective, there must be meaningful cooperation between the Democratic Party of the president and the Republican Party, the new victors. Second point, with regard to what's happening now in Africa, and that is, in Africa, what happened in Burkina Faso is instructive. The leadership in this country must learn the same game the Americans just came from. You cannot rule one country by yourself or one party for a long time. You have to allow other groups to win power. And you create a new game of political bargaining and compromise. This is the lesson for all of us from the American election. President Obama's party lost, but what he lost is instructive to the Americans. The mandate of the Republican Party was not overwhelming. They did not have 66% of the vote. But regardless of what his outcome is, they won. They won. They won. Thank you for listening.
And thank you very much, Dr. Yang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Fraser, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Zubir El Tayeb. We say a big thanks for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, those whose palm kernels were cracked for them by a benevolent spirit should not forget to be humble. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. According to the recent synthesis report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, our planet is in deep trouble. The panel's assessment states that most of the negative impact done to our environment because of climate change is man-made and primarily caused by the burning of fossil fuels. The evidence is clear, growing, and observable on every continent and throughout the ocean. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are unprecedented in the last 800,000 years. Because of this buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, each of the past three decades has been warmer than the one preceding it, and this heat is acidifying the ocean, melting glaciers, sea ice, and ice sheets around the world, and causing sea levels to rise at never-seen-before rates. Severe weather events such as major storms, droughts, and temperature extremes are becoming more common. These changes pose severe, widespread, and potentially irreversible risks to communities and livelihoods of the approximately 100 million people who live no more than 1 meter above sea level, as they are among the most vulnerable. The report states that there is a real risk of irreversible impacts, but it also stresses that we can stem the worst effects from climate change by cutting greenhouse gas emissions between 40 and 70% by 2050 and by eliminating them altogether by 2100. This means phasing out coal and natural gas for production of electricity or coming up with a way to trap carbon dioxide emissions. This report is another canary in the coal mine, said Secretary of State John Kerry. We can't prevent a large-scale disaster if we don't heed this kind of hard science. The longer we are stuck in a debate over ideology and politics, the more the costs of inaction grow and grow. Those who choose to ignore or dispute the science so clearly laid out in this report do so at great risk for all of us, for our kids and grandkids, he said. We have a small window of opportunity to address the problem before it becomes too widespread and too expensive to fix. This is a matter of the quality of life on Earth for generations to come. With this assessment, hundreds of scientists have spoken. Now it is up to the politicians to make some very hard decisions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.